The last time we talked about taxes, it was right before the fiscal cliff deadline, and there was a lot of uncertainty about what would be resolved, what wouldn't, and how. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller today. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. For better or worse, we're on the other side of the fiscal cliff deadline, and everyone from individual taxpayers up through the IRS can now get a better handle on what has changed, what'll stay the same, and how it impacts our taxes. Dale Kunin is a certified public accountant and a certified information technology professional. She has an MS in accounting science from UW-Madison and has over 20 years of experience as an accounting professional working in public accounting, private industry, government, and education. She's a partner with Wagner CPAs in Madison, and she has shared her expertise with us several times already, and lucky for us, she's here again. Dale, thanks so much for coming back to the show.
Glad to be here.
Well, we have lots to talk about and happily a lot more concrete things to talk about. Last time you were on, there was a lot of uncertainty about our fiscal cliff and what was going to happen and how it was going to impact taxes. So we'll definitely talk about that. But this time of year especially, many of us are probably seeing interest income statements and W-2s coming in the mail. What are the deadlines for organizations or employers to get those documents to us?
The 1099s that you get from your bank, also from your investment, if you have broker mutual funds, or if you have miscellaneous income that is not paid through a W-2, the rule is that the recipient has to have them in their hands by January 31st, and the employer has to file them with the state of Wisconsin, if applicable. Mm-hmm. Also by that date, there's a you can go out to the end of February for the employer to actually make the filing with the federal government, the Social Security Administration. So you should have everything in your hands by the 31st of January.
But having been said,
exactly.
Here we are on February 7th, and what if people have not received some of those things?
Well, if you haven't received them, you need to contact the responsible party. A lot of the brokerage houses, this for mutual fund statements and securities investments, they'll send out something so that it's in your hands in January, but they'll say this could change, and they'll send out, it's really typical that they'll send out an amended form once, twice, in February. Some of the larger brokerage houses and mutual funds have gotten extensions from the IRS to file those, you know, in February. Not a lot, but typically you see that you'll get one that we basically say, we're not going to use this yet because we figure that they're going to
send. It's going to change.
It's going to change, and it drives everybody crazy, but it's pretty typical that we'll get an amended and keeping all the different papers straight. So
is there a time where it's safe to think, okay, no more amendments coming?
Well, in general, I would say by mid-February, but they
never
can always
never
amend it. So.
Okay. And so, is there a threshold of how much would be showing up on those different statements, whether we should expect a statement or not? Like for a 1099, like you said, for miscellaneous income, does everyone have to issue a 1099 for any amount? Or if it's under a certain amount, is it just the taxpayer's responsibility to make note of that?
Well, they're all different. So for the 1099 miscellaneous, which has a place to put rent, prizes, and non-employee compensation and other income. The rule is that those have to be issued to unincorporated individuals who the business paid for a service, a business service, not for products, not for supplies. The rule is that they have to issue one if it's $600 or more total. And law firms, whether they're incorporated or not, are also supposed to be the recipient of a 1099 if it's more than $600. So, but not receiving one does not excuse the taxpayer from reporting that income.
And I think we had a call about that the last time you were on. So that's an important point to make. Say someone did, you know, some work for somebody and earned $500, just because they don't have a 1099 coming to them doesn't mean they're not responsible to pay taxes on that $500.
Exactly.
Or to declare that $500.
Right. And then for interest, a lot of the banks don't send a separate interest 1099 if it's a small amount. They report that on the year end, your last statement that you get, either electronically or in the mail. So you are responsible for reporting that, even if you don't get a 1099.
We're talking with Dale Kunin. She's a certified public accountant and an expert in tax preparation. Happy to answer your questions when you join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email at talk@wpr.org. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller. And Dale, why don't we go ahead and just go to the phones and start answering some folks' questions. Amy in Edgerton is up first. Hi, Amy.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm fortunate that I don't have a lot of deductions. I can file easy forms and the Wisconsin easy, well, Z form. And I've found a major discrepancy between my filing on a major name online, and then I typically file for free on my state with the Department of Revenue. Well, the online company tells me that I'm getting over $400 back, and the Wisconsin Department of Revenue tells me I owe over $900. And I've never had this happen before. And I can't imagine what I did differently. I really don't have any deductions. It's very simple.
Hmm. So you're wondering what might be creating that discrepancy between the two.
So
have you heard of anything?
You filed through you prepared the return through an online.
Yep, through a major online.
And they had the state return as part of it?
Yeah, they tell you that they estimate you'll be getting $400 back, and that's been the case. For years, I've done it for free online.
But is there actually a state form that is produced, or they're just telling you that based on...
It could be if I do it, but I don't do it through them because I don't want to pay $25 or whatever.
Right. That's what I was going to say is that my understanding was that those online freebies are for the federal return, but if you want to prepare a state return... that you have to make an extra payment. And Wisconsin taxes are among the most complicated of the states. They don't follow the federal tax rules exactly. And so most of the big name, they aren't set up for Wisconsin. And so if they just gave you an estimate, it probably was their estimate, but without having prepared the form...
They don't have all the information.
They don't have it, yeah.
I understand. So then my question would be, has something changed majorly with the Wisconsin tax code?
No.
I've never owed. Never.
Hmm. Has anything changed with your situation, Amy, that might explain that?
Nope. I had the same job for 7 years. I made about the same amount of money.
And was the same amount withheld for mm-hmm. you during the...
Yeah, pretty close. Pretty close, yeah.
I would just suggest that you check your preparation, that you make sure you've checked the exemptions, I don't know if you have dependents, and if you got a rent credit or if you took advantage of that. There's a line for getting a credit against taxes owed. Maximum is $300 for rent that you pay. So there's not been a dramatic change in Wisconsin.
But I'm guessing, as much as this isn't probably the answer that Amy's hoping for, that whatever came up on the Wisconsin submission site is probably the right one.
If she checked, if she filled it out correctly.
Yeah. Yeah. So double checking, that would be the first thing. Mm-hmm. All right. Sorry about that, Amy, and good luck with that. Let's go next to Mike in Chicago. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. I would like to know what limits there are, if any, on the dollar amount and on the number of residents for which someone can claim the mortgage interest deduction. And I'll listen off the air.
So wait, hang on just a second, Mike, because I want to make sure we have your question right. So you're saying if someone owns two residences or three residences.
Or four.
Can they, and those are all, they're not rental properties, they're all.
Correct.
Okay. So whether someone can claim the mortgage interest as a deduction on all of those homes, if they're paying on all those homes.
Or is it limited to some amount of money or some number of homes?
Okay. So whether there's a cap to how much, how many homes you can claim that on or how much you can claim.
Well, there is ultimately a limit on on how much you can claim on a specific mortgage. It has to do with the if you can't just take out a loan of $1 million and spend it on non-house things and be able to deduct it. So there are some limits as far as if you have a mortgage interest. If it's not an investment property or rental property.
No, it sounds like they're actually residences for the
multiple residences, more than one.
Yeah.
I think that there are some limits. Let me just think about that. The exact. I mean, you can definitely take the mortgage on your first home and your second home.
Okay, well, while you're looking at that, I'll remind people that they're listening to The Larry Mueller Show on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller and visiting with Dale Kunin, who's a CPA and tax specialist. She's answering your tax questions, how to file, when to file, what to file. Dale can handle it all. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org, and we will be happy to get those questions to Dale. So the question that Mike in Chicago had was about whether there's a cap or what kind of a cap there is on the mortgage interest you can take on multiple homes that
are... You can take mortgage interest on a first home and a second home.
Okay.
That are residences. And then if they're not, if you have other homes that are not rental properties,
you're just out of luck.
Right. And then on an individual amount, you can deduct interest on acquisition debt, meaning when you buy the home, you paid for the home. It has to be a secured debt. You know, it has to be the home is securing the debt. If the debt's limited to $1 million, as I said before, for a married couple, and it has to be when you refinance the debt, as long as you're not exceeding the principal that was outstanding before you refinanced it, and if you borrow additional money to make substantial improvements in the home, that's also deductible as acquisition debt. If you have a home equity loan, it's limited. That deductibility is limited to the fair market value of the home minus the debt you already have on it, or $100,000 for your first and second homes, whichever's less. So there are limits on what's deductible. If you have a third home or fourth home and it's not business property, it's not rental property, you can't deduct the interest.
All right. And it sounds like something that complex and kind of unusual, might make sense to talk to a tax preparer and make sure that it's all, that you're taking advantage of what you can and not taking advantage of things you shouldn't.
Right.
Basically.
You can't deduct mortgage on six homes even if the total is less than $1 million.
It's the Larry Mueller Show on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Talking about your taxes today with Dale Kunin. She's a CPA and tax specialist with Wagner CPAs here in Madison. And just want to let you know, tomorrow at 11, it's time for another edition of Garden Talk. Shelley Ryan is the Wisconsin gardener, and she'll give us a sneak peek at the next season of her show on Wisconsin Public Television and a preview of this weekend's Garden Expo happening at the Alliant Energy Center here in Madison. But right now, we're talking taxes with Dale Kunin. And Dale, what kind of life changes affect our taxes and how? Things like birth, adoption, marriage, divorce?
All of the above. Marriage changes your filing status and affects limits, phase outs. There's different phase out levels for different deductions, or based on whether you're married or single. Certainly a birth adds a additional dependent exemption, and those are worth a deduction, $3,700. And if you, I think the most significant tax change is usually a divorce, because certainly in the year of the divorce, it can be very complicated. Wisconsin's a community property state, a marital property state, and even if you think that you're divorced, if you're separated, there are many situations where you still have to, even if you're filing separately, you have to split your income and expenses down the, you know, in the middle,
right,
whether you intended to or not. And then your filing status is going to change. You're going to go from married filing jointly to single, or if there's a child involved, you can be head of household, which is a more favorable filing status. And then, of course, all the expenses and change of income in a divorce is probably the most drastic change.
Not to mention you're having to do these things jointly with someone that In many situations, you're not feeling too positively about, so it can be pretty challenging. Mm-hmm. What about adoption? Are there specific things that an adoption affects that are different from the birth of a child?
Adopting a child gets you an exemption the same as birth. In fact, if you were supporting that child before the adoption is final and you were supporting them, they are a dependent. There are credits available for adoptions, especially for special needs children, and they can be up to just under $13,000 of a credit. A credit is a reduction of the taxes owed, not a deduction of the taxable income. Hmm. And they are available for adoptions, both U.S. adoptions and foreign adoptions. They are the expenses that you pay for the cost of the adoption are eligible for this credit if it's a foreign adoption in the year that the adoption is final, and for a domestic, it's in the year that you pay them. And those expenses, the credits can be very generous, but they're not refundable, meaning that if you owed $1,000 of taxes and your credit was $2,000, you're not going to get that money back, but you can carry forward the credit for 5 years.
Oh, okay. Okay, great. Well, we have several people on the line waiting to talk with you, so let's go back to the phones and Lynn in Milwaukee. Hi, Lynn.
Good morning. I last year got a legal settlement, and I don't know how to report it on my taxes.
Well, it depends on what the nature of the settlement was. If it can be, if it was in lieu of compensation, if it was income related, it is taxable as miscellaneous income.
It was as a result of a civil suit. Some city officials did something they shouldn't have.
Well, it probably is taxable. This is where you should consult with a tax professional and go through the specifics of the situation, the case with that professional to determine how you're going to report that that award.
And Dale, is that something that she would actually receive a 1099 for or not?
It depends on the law firm. If there was a law firm involved and they had and they paid it out of their trust account, they may or may not.
Okay.
And because again, 1099s are required for services provided in the course of a business. So if you didn't have services, mm-hmm. she wasn't a service provider.
Right.
So there's just a lot of circumstances that we'd have to know the details are. I don't know if she would get a 1099. Again, I don't know if it was the city that paid or if it was through attorney.
Through a trust.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, Lynn, it sounds like talking with a tax preparation person would make sense to make sure that you're claiming it if you need to and not if you don't. Let's go next to Joel in Appleton. Hi, Joel.
Hey, good morning. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How about you?
Thank you. Yes, I'm doing well, too. Just bracing for the storm.
There you go. Batting down those hatches.
Yeah, exactly. Getting the shovel ready. Hey, we own a home. We actually own two. last year, we purchased a new home because we wanted to relocate to another side of town so we could be closer to the kids' school. We were unable to sell our old home last year, and so we took it off the market and we rented it out to somebody. Now we're gearing up to put it back on the market, and I'm wondering how we account for it in our tax forms. Can we just treat it as our home still, or is it a rental? How does it work?
So how long has someone been renting?
For most of last year.
Okay. Dale, what do you think?
Well, there's if you are renting your home incidental to selling it, you need to report the income that you received for rent, but you don't have to treat the home as if it was a rental property. So you would treat it, you deduct the mortgage interest that you would be able to deduct and real estate taxes that you paid, and not depreciate it, report the rental income as rental income. If you had specific costs to get that rental income, you can deduct those, but not the cost of like maintaining the home. And then you're putting it back on the market, and you've qualified for this temporary situation.
Oh, that's good to know. So we do TurboTax, right? And they sell the deluxe version, which gives you state and federal. But we were wondering if we should take it back and get the premium edition, which gives you like rental forms and stuff. The deluxe version doesn't have it. And so we were just like,
you do need to report your rental income.
But is that special forms?
Yes, there is a special form.
What is that? Is that the Schedule E?
It is.
Okay. Okay, so we gotta use the Schedule E then to report that. Is the income anything beyond what we're paying in interest and base on our loan, as well as the taxes for the place?
You mean the income or the expenses?
Well, the expenses, yeah. What exactly? I'm sorry. Yeah, the income. What what qualifies as income?
The rental income that you received. If you rented the home and the people living in it paid you rent, then that's the income that you would report.
Okay. Well, and then what do we – we can subtract the property taxes and the money that we pay towards the mortgage on it.
Just the mortgage interest, not
just
the
mortgage interest.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, Joel. Good luck with that. And let's go to Lawrence in La Crosse next. Hi, Lawrence.
Hi. I have a question about domestic production activity deduction for agriculture on the federal and how it relates to the Wisconsin.
All right.
And I understand you might not be able to answer off the top of your head on the radio, but my understanding is you have to add the deduction back to Wisconsin.
It's not a deduction for Wisconsin. Yes,
you have to adjust the Wisconsin income by adding it back on.
Essentially, yeah.
Okay. So my next question is for 2013. I don't know. I thought I read on the Wisconsin website that they may be introducing a kind of a similar credit for agriculture and manufacturing for Wisconsin next year. I don't know if that's been passed or not. Do you?
I'm sorry. I don't know.
There's a lot that's up in the air right now, I know, on Wisconsin taxes for this year and next.
Yes. And our focus has been historical because we're in the thick of preparing the tax returns for 2012, so it's like we don't often turn over the new year until the tax season's over. I don't know. I can check into it, and perhaps Judith can post something on on the Facebook page later, but I'm not aware of the status of that.
All right. Thanks for that call, Lawrence. And you can join the conversation. We're talking with Dale Kunin, CPA and tax specialist from Wegner CPAs in Madison. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller today. And you can join in by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Our on-air producer today is Gabby Pedriani. And she'll be happy to take your calls. Let's go next to Jeff in Green Bay. Hi, Jeff.
Hello. See, I have an S corporation, and I'm looking at sponsoring a scholarship program for further education. About 2 weeks ago, I was on the phone with the IRS for over an hour, and they kept transferring me.
Okay, just an hour, Jeff?
It was an hour, believe it. Anyways, they couldn't answer it, and next question is, can I do that? And as far as the recipient goes for that scholarship, are there any laws on who can receive that scholarship? Can it be family members? Can it be only certain other people?
So first off, let's explain what an S corporation is, Dale, for people that might not know.
An S corporation is a tax entity that is elected by the owners of a corporation. So the corporation is formed, registered with the state Department of Financial Institutions as a corporation, and then with the IRS, the status of S corp is selected, and it changes the way that the tax returns the tax status of the entity. We call it a pass-through entity because the revenue, the net revenue, the net income, passes through to the owners like a partnership does. Hmm. So they get a K-1, and the S-Corp itself is not a taxable entity. So I think what you're asking is there a way for you to pay for tuition for a family member and deduct it from your business? I think that might be.
Is that about right, Jeff?
Yeah, that's in a roundabout way, yeah.
Okay.
So you have to have, in order to do that, you'd have to have a qualified plan where you give tuition payments on behalf of an individual. And since you are the I don't know if are you the only employee of the S Corp?
Yes, I own the company and I'm considered an employee of that company.
Are you the only employee?
Correct.
So what you're really doing, the corporation, is passing through, it would be treated as compensation, additional compensation to you. And so you'd end up having to report it as compensation, which is means that if you deducted it, you'd have to report it as income. So unless you can set up an actual scholarship fund that is maybe a nonprofit entity, or have a scholarship that you entertain other applicants for that have certain qualifications. But to just deduct the tuition that you pay on behalf of your child or spouse that don't work for the company and it's not furthering their employment, there really isn't a way to deduct that.
All right. Well, thanks for that call, Jeff. And let's go next to Ron in Manitowoc. Hi, Ron.
Thanks.
Sure.
I'm wondering if you could describe the method to calculate the capital gains on a stock which was held for a number of years and dividends were reinvested.
So the capital gain is the difference between what you've got into that security, that stock, meaning what you paid for it originally, and all the dividends that you reinvested, and what you sold it for. So we run across this a lot where somebody's owned a stock for a long time or a mutual fund, and they've reinvested the dividends, and so and they haven't kept records. If you've kept records, that's great because then it's going to be simple. Otherwise, we go back through prior tax returns to see what dividends were reported, because even though they're reinvested, they have to be reported as income, and create a schedule either on a spreadsheet or manually that takes that original cost and adds back, you know, year one, year two, year three, year four, year five of dividends, and then you've got your basis in the stock, and that's what you would report as your adjusted basis and the difference between the selling price less any commissions and that amount that you've calculated on your schedule is your capital gain. And yeah, it's tedious, and you do need, if you can't go back and document the dividends that you've reinvested, then your recourse is to report only the original cost, and that's going to make your gain, if it's a gain, larger. So it's in your best interest to find the data and add it all up.
Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for that.
Good luck.
Thanks for that call, Ron. And Joan and Stoddard next. Hi, Joan.
Hi. I understand that there's an income limit for a person to be able to purchase a Roth IRA, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And then if you purchase a Roth IRA, since you don't even write it down on your taxes, how would they even know that you were above the income limit for that Roth IRA?
And just let's explain briefly the difference between a Roth IRA and a traditional IRA, Dale, for those that might not know.
So a traditional IRA is a savings vehicle for retirement where you can deduct the amount that you put in each year, and it grows tax-free until you take it out, and you have to start taking it out when you're 70 and a half, and at that point you have income taxes to pay on it.
So you don't, you're with the traditional, you're not paying anything in taxes now. It's
you're
all
deferring
it's all
it.
At the end when you withdraw.
Right. And if there's you know, growth, a lot of growth, it's all happened tax free and you don't pay taxes till you take it out. A Roth IRA is a really great opportunity to you do not deduct that amount from your tax return, but you create a an investment of for the Roth, and it grows tax free, and you never have to pay taxes on anything that's in there
because you're paying. You're not paying taxes. Well, you're using money that was taxable to start it. And so you take care of the taxes up front.
But the growth, this is the gift that Congress gave, the growth is tax-free. So, yes, you funded it with after-tax money, but the potential for it to grow and grow and grow, there's not ever going to be another tax on it. And you don't have to take it out when you're 70 and a half.
Mm-hmm.
So your heirs don't have to pay income tax on it either. So that's what a Roth is. And I've already forgot what
that
your question was.
The limit. Joan's question
oh,
was.
Oh, how you would know. Okay. So.
And what is the limit on having a Roth?
I'm looking up this year's limit for you to make a Roth contribution. For 2012, the adjusted gross income, if it's more than $173,000, it starts getting phased out. And if for a married couple, and for single, it's $110,000.
Okay.
Then your question about how would they know? This is not the relevant question. Because as a taxpayer, you're required to follow the rules, and there is a penalty for an excess contribution, and so they would know if you get audited, if somebody takes a look at it, and that's the way that they would know.
And so the limit, just to be sure that I'm clear, the limit comes into play by how much you're making. It's not a limit
total
on how much total income. It's not a limit on how much you can put into a Roth.
Oh, no, there is a
okay.
There is a limit on how much you can put in. The contribution, if you're allowed, and it's the same for a deductible and a Roth IRA, the limits are the same, and it was 5,000, I think that per person.
Okay,
but it has to be you have to have earned income before you can do it. So if you don't have earned income, you can't make an IRA or a Roth contribution. You have
okay.
to have earned income.
It has to be coming out of money you've actually earned,
and
basically.
The limit is 5,000 if you're under 50, but if your total earned income was only 4,000, that's your limit.
That's your
as
limit.
Well.
Okay.
And the limit, you can, if you're over 50, you can contribute a catch-up contribution. So if you're over 50, you can go with 6,000.
Great. All right. I hope that helped, Joan. And we're happy to help you as well when you call 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller today, talking with Dale Kunin, who is a CPA with Wegner CPAs here in Madison. She is a tax specialist and happy to help you with your tax questions. Talking taxes with CPA Dale Kunin. And Dale, sorry, we went to the break and you had something you wanted to add.
I just wanted to add about the excess contributions. That was the last, mm-hmm. for both a Roth and a traditional IRA, there's a 6%, they call it an excise tax penalty on excess contributions, which, so it is... Those are the rules, and how they enforce them is by, you know, taxpayer compliance.
All right. All right. We've had quite a few emails. I want to go to a few of those now. An email, I'm the sole beneficiary of a couple of IRAs owned by my mother. She passed away this January and had not taken her required minimum distribution for this year. When the minimum is taken, does the income go to her estate or to the person emailing?
If the IRA has been retitled into, and it's a post-death transaction, then it would go to you personally.
Well, and I'm just curious because it says I'm the sole beneficiary of a couple IRAs. So wouldn't it still go to the person directly instead of going through the estate if they are the
yes.
listed beneficiary?
If it's not usually part of the probate because it had a named beneficiary.
Right. Okay. And an email from Catherine. What are the criteria for considering a 20-year-old college student a dependent, and how much would that deduction be?
If you are supporting that college student, and the support test is that you provide more than 50% of their support, and support includes everything, including vacation and clothes and laundry, besides just paying for their room and board. So if you provide more than 50% of that, then they are your dependent. If they're a full-time student, if they're working, there's no limit on what they can earn that makes them, that they can still be your dependent.
Oh, okay.
As long as they're under 24 or under 25, so 24 or younger. And if they, so the support test includes tuition, but it includes everything else.
Mm-hmm.
So if they're paying their own tuition, but you're providing, you know, car, insurance, everything, most college students, we tend to support our children in college, and they are dependents.
Okay, great. And let's take one more email before we go back to the phones. Listener Kathy has filed for bankruptcy, and she wonders how that will impact her tax filing.
Filing for bankruptcy doesn't change your situation. You have to report your income, and you're entitled to the same expenses that a taxpayer. There's nothing on the tax return that addresses bankruptcy, either whether you're in bankruptcy or filed for bankruptcy. You still have to file a tax return if you had income that qualifies you. And if there's some debts that were forgiven, if they were forgiven and you have discharged in bankruptcy, is a way not to have to report the forgiven debt as income. But because forgiven debt is subject to income tax, but discharged in bankruptcy, if you are at that stage, then you may not have to report it.
All right. And let's go back to the phones. Dick in Cudahy is next. Hi, Dick.
Good morning. My question is this. City of Cudahy has had a sidewalk replacement program going on, whereas if your sidewalk is cracked or it's out of kilter, city deems it has to be replaced. We were billed separately for the sidewalk replacement rather than put on our property taxes. Is that a deduction?
That's a very good question, and one that that comes up quite a bit. The status of special assessments, of which sidewalk assessments is a frequent one. The maintenance and repair costs are if it does, if it's just maintenance and repair, this assessments can be deducted as property taxes. But if they're improvements, it's not necessarily deductible. So sidewalks, the improvement of sidewalks, so that assessment is not a is not treated as property tax. So I'm not
So a replacement could be considered an improvement?
That is a matter of interpretation. It really has to do with whether your property values are affected or not. So if that's the measure. If the improvement is changing your property values, which I don't know if they are or not, then they're not eligible to be property taxes. Maintenance and repairs are. So if they're replacing the sidewalks, I mean they're taking them out, that's probably not property tax deduction. But people interpret that different ways.
All right. Well, good luck with that, Dick. Mm-hmm. And let's go next to Thomas in Deerfield. Hi, Thomas.
Hello. I have a person asked me this question, and I didn't have the answer. A person, I think, is in the late 30s or 40 years old. What's the limit of how, when you have to file, you have to always file a return, no matter what, if you make like less than $5,000 or whatever.
So basically, is there an amount under which you don't need to file a return, Dale?
Yes, and I'm sorry, I didn't quite catch the person that was asking about whether it was age related or.
Well, it was. I think he was pointing out that it's an adult.
Oh, okay. So general filing requirements is based on income, and it is whether you have income. If you're single, you have to file a return if you have gross income of $11,200 or more. If you're married, you have to file, if you're filing jointly, if you have gross income of $21,800 or more
for the household.
Yeah, but there are different levels for over 65 as well. But those are the basic who must file a return, federal return.
And you said $11,200.
Yes,
for $21,000.
No, for under 65, it's $9,700 or nine.
Okay.
Yeah, if you're over 65, it's a little more.
Okay.
And it's $19,500 for under 65 for a couple. So that's the basic income test. There may be other filing requirements if you owe some special taxes or you had self-employment income of more than 400, you have to file a tax return because you have to pay self-employment tax. And so there's some other reasons that you might have to.
But those are kind of the basics. We're coming up on a break, but Deb in Black Earth has a really useful comment. So let's go there quickly. Hi, Deb.
Good morning. How are you?
Good.
So earlier caller called in regarding basis calculation when reinvesting dividends. And you can go into Yahoo Finance and type in the symbol, and it will give you all the historical dividends that have been paid.
So that's a really easy way to find that information that Dale was saying. Well, it's great if you keep records or keep track of it. But again, so you go to Yahoo and in the finance section and you put in the stock symbol and it'll put up the history for those dividends. So thanks so much for that, Deb. It's always great when our listeners can help other listeners. And we'll be happy to continue helping you after a look at the NPR News. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in for Larry Mueller today. Dale Kunin is a certified public accountant and a tax specialist with Wagner CPAs here in Madison. She has many years of experience, and she's happy to help you with your tax questions. Do you wonder what you need to do differently this year, or maybe your life situation has changed and you want to know how that impacts your taxes? We're happy to help. You can call 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Stay tuned. If the thought that tax day is about 2 months away raises your blood pressure, I can guarantee that you're not alone. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Thanks for spending time with us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Chances are you have some questions about how to file your taxes correctly and what has changed from previous years. We're happy to have CPA and tax specialist Dale Kunin with us for the next half hour. She has lots of great advice and tips, and she's happy to answer your questions, too. Wonder how life changes like a new job, getting married, or buying a home might change your taxes for better or worse? Want to know how to decrease your taxable income for next year? Or wonder what credits or rebates are available? We can answer that when you call us at 1-800-642-1234. And I hope you'll visit our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mueller Show. If you like it, you'll get daily updates on upcoming topics. More after the news. Benjamin Franklin said that in this world, nothing can be said to be certain except death and taxes. But one big difference is that tax day comes around every year. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller today. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Now that 2012 is over and done with, we can turn our attention to putting together our tax returns. Dale Kunin is a certified public accountant and a certified information technology professional. She has an MS in accounting science from UW-Madison and has over 20 years of experience as an accounting professional working in public accounting, private industry, government, and education. She's a partner with Wagner CPAs in Madison. Dale, thanks for spending time with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And I know that people are anxious to get their questions answered, but you wanted to add something about finding historical dividend information on Yahoo Finance, which was a great suggestion from Devin Black Earth, but there's one caveat.
Yeah, it's a great suggestion, and, you know, I use Google all the time. The one thing about that is if it's an older stock, we see this a lot, and the person's held it for a long time, there may have been stock splits going back. And so if it says how much the dividend was per share of stock, they don't always know how many shares they had at that time. So you can find that information out also on Yahoo when a stock split, but it's not just a one-to-one.
Great. That's great information to have. And for those that weren't listening, perhaps the question was about how to figure out the basis for claiming stock dividends.
Right. How much you have in it.
Right. And let's actually take care of this quick email from Dee. The question was, do you have to claim money from active military service on taxes?
There is an exclusion if you are
in a combat
zone.
Yes.
Otherwise, yeah, you have to pay taxes on what you earn.
All right, and let's go to Tom in Platteville. Hi, Tom.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
Yes. My question is, about 10 years ago, my mom and dad put us on the deed with their house. And they passed away. Mom passed away last year.
Sorry.
I sold the house in 2012. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And we received 10 siblings. We all each received a 1099-S form from the title company for our share of the house when we sold it.
Yes.
Is that taxable?
Well, it's reportable. And it's reportable, your share, and then what your basis is in it. So if you received if you were put on the deed, I don't know when you were put on the deed, at that point you all had a value, but most, even if you're put on the deed and you the deed wasn't taken from your mom, she still was on a two, then the date of death value of the house is split between the, I think you said there were 10 of you.
10 siblings.
And so whatever your proceeds were, minus that basis, it's just like the stock that we were just mm-hmm. talking about. So you would report it, but it probably isn't taxable because if you sold it soon after the death, then the value is going to be your cost in it is the stepped up basis from when the date of your mom's death.
So there, if it was
yes,
just a few months or something, there probably wasn't a big difference
exactly.
in the value of the
exactly.
The home. All right, thanks for that call, Tom. And Martha in Green Bay is next. Hi, Martha.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is about working from home. I work for a business that has a place of employment, but I'm not required to work from that facility. So I work from home pretty much almost 99% of the time. So can we take a deduction on our and our taxes on that in terms of the I'm paying, obviously, electricity on my home, but I also use it for business?
So the question that I would ask you is, are you a employee of this business? Do you receive a W-2?
Yes.
So there's the answer is yes and no. So as an employee, you can take you are eligible to take a deduction for your office in a home if everything else qualifies, but it's subject to whether you take itemized deductions. So I don't know if you're already taking itemized deductions. And then it's considered a miscellaneous itemized deduction, which has a 2% of adjusted gross income threshold. So only amounts over that are even in the pot to be deducted. So it's very difficult for an employee to take advantage of, to be able to take advantage of the deductions for the home.
As opposed to someone who's working for themselves
yes.
out of their home and working as a consultant or a
yes.
contractor, right?
Yeah. Because okay. your status is employee and it's an employee business expense.
Okay. Thanks for that call, Martha. And actually, there's a somewhat similar question on the Facebook page from Aaron. Aaron says, I do some freelance work on the side and wonder how I report that income. I'm not registered as an LLC or anything like that, just as myself. Total income from that activity is maybe $2,000. Do I just report it as miscellaneous income, or are there other forms I need to fill out? What taxes are applicable to be taken on that?
So, you are subject to self-employment taxes on that. And if you had any expenses that you had as to earn that income, you can deduct those against that amount. So the place that it belongs is on a Schedule C or a Schedule CEZ. And if you have absolutely no deductions or nothing else to report, you could possibly report it as miscellaneous income, but it's subject to self-employment tax. So you will need a Form SE to report that as well.
All right. Good luck with that, Aaron. We are talking with CPA Dale Kunin of Wagner CPAs here in Madison. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller, talking about tax preparation. And we had an email from Jeff in Hudson. Jeff says, I've been unemployed all year and living off of early withdrawal of my 401k. Should this be taxed differently than if it weren't an emergency?
You will not have to pay if it's for support when you are unemployed. There is a provision for not being subject to a penalty. So I'm not sure if you're taking the money out or you're borrowing it or what. But
sounds like he said early withdrawal. So I'm thinking taking it out.
So there is the option to not have to pay the penalty, which is 10%. Of the withdrawals, but you still are subject to income tax on those withdrawals.
Okay. All right. And then we had an email from Jordan in Pewaukee. Even if expenses like union dues and job travel are small, are they still deductible? And is there any way to deduct those small amounts without losing the standard deduction?
No, it's an either or. It's the same situation as the listener had about the home office. As an employee, yes, your union dues and
travel expenses
that are not
job
reimbursed
travel, yeah.
are eligible to be deducted as an employee business expense. Again, it's part of the itemized deduction. So if you don't have enough other deductions, you can't take it in addition to your standard deduction.
So it's either or.
And it's, again, subject to that 2% adjusted gross income to even hit the itemized deduction total.
All right. Let's go back to the phones and Tom and Alma Center. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. My question is this. My father died in 2012, in November of 2012. He had life insurance policies set up, and he had an LLC set up for his children. We received some of the insurance money, the insurance policy money in 2012, and we received the LLC inheritance in 2013. When do we have to claim that? And do we claim it in 2012, 2013, and do we have to pay the inheritance tax and all that stuff on it?
So,
I know it's a big, huge question.
I'm so sorry for your loss. I'm not quite sure what you mean about an LLC that was set up, so I may need more information about that. Life insurance proceeds are not subject to income tax. If you're, when your father passed away, there was either things had to go through probate or has a trust set up, and so whether there needs to be an estate tax return prepared depends on how much he had in his estate. But I'm stumped on what you mean by he set up an LLC for you.
Okay, the LLC was set up. I have a large family. I have many brothers and sisters. What happened was he had to go into a nursing home, and we set up an LLC to put his money into for the a corporation type thing, I guess. So I don't know exactly how it worked. So,
well, I don't think I can answer your question. An LLC, if it's truly an LLC, is a business entity, has to have a business purpose, and if there's multiple owners of the LLC, then any income from there is passed through to the beneficiaries or the owners of the LLC, and it's taxed through the return that is prepared for the LLC. But the life insurance, doesn't matter when you received it, you don't report it, and it's not taxable.
All right. Thanks for that, Tom. And let's go to Margie in Price County. Hi, Margie.
Hello.
Go ahead.
I have a question. My husband is an independent logger, and he purchased a pole skidder in 2012. And my question is whether he should take the entire cost of the skidder as an expense on his Schedule C or depreciate it, and if depreciation, what method and how many years should he depreciate it for, because the machine is about 35 years old and it only costs $7,000.
Since he's a cash-based taxpayer, I assume he is, and he has a Schedule C, he can take the 179 deduction, which means he can expense it all. It's a choice. And if you, since he paid cash for it in 2012, you may want to deduct it in the same year that he paid for it so that you can see the immediate tax advantage. If you anticipate he's going to be in a higher tax bracket or something that you, in the future, and you want to spread the deduction out, then there is that option. Most typically we see if you make a major purchase, you take advantage of being able to expense the whole thing in that same year.
And okay, what line would that go on? Is Schedule C?
It's a separate form, a 4562, a depreciation form. That's where he has to report it, and then it comes into the Schedule C from that form.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Margie. And, you know, last time you were on, Dale, we were teetering on the edge of the fiscal cliff, and even more than today, the answers to a lot of questions were, well, it depends.
Yeah.
And so here we are, you know, for better or worse, on the other side of that deadline. What did get changed, and, you know, what do we know now that we didn't know right before the fiscal cliff?
Well, for 2012, the biggest issues were the alternative minimum tax, and they fixed that. And when we sat here before, we had no idea if they were. It had never gone to the point so far in the end of the year. And in fact, they didn't fix it until the night of January 1st, but they fixed it for 2012. And that was a big unknown for how we were going to have to prepare returns. And in fact, there were just a lot of things that were not known. There were some education credits that were extended, and actually the IRS has delayed when they will accept filing of returns with tuition deductions and education credits. Their computers aren't set up to handle that yet, and I think it's mid-February before they're going to accept those at all. And so we know that, and as far as for 2013, we know what the tax rates are, and by and large the tax rates for middle class were kept the same. The only changes were in people making more than $400,000, and the other thing that changed that we didn't know for sure is that the payroll tax holiday ended, and so everybody has to pay from their salaries and wages the full 6.2% for Social Security. So that was a change that hit everybody at the beginning of January. And there's also a surtax that applies for people who on investment income for people who earn more than $200,000. And that's a 3.8% surtax.
Okay.
There's other things, but I think that's the highlights.
All right. The highlights or the lowlights, depending on what we're looking at. One question that we often get is, you know, we've had people today talking about using TurboTax or other online filings. And there, we had a question. There's a site at the IRS where you can file for free. It says if your individual income is less than $57,000, even if you're filing married jointly, is there a higher income or is that still the 57? It's a site that the IRS has. It's free file through the IRS, but they say you have to be earning $57,000 or less.
I don't know. It's usually, I don't know the answer to that. And
the person tried to find it on the IRS site and couldn't find an explanation anywhere whether there was a higher limit, as there often is if it's, you know, they're considering two incomes.
I think that is on a joint return that is the
that's
limit.
Still the limit.
But I honestly I don't know because I haven't really visited that site.
Okay. And George in Franklin is up next. Hi, George.
Hello. My wife and I are 85 and 86 on Social Security. We recently moved just the last part of last year from Michigan to Wisconsin, and we did not pay any federal or state income taxes. Now, my question is, do I have to file a return in Wisconsin?
Well, welcome to Wisconsin.
Yes, I was going to say the same thing. We're happy to have you, George.
and yes, there are filing requirements in Wisconsin. It's based on income limits. And when you say you didn't pay income taxes, it means you didn't have to. Are you meaning you didn't have to file a return?
Well, we didn't have to file a return. I have our income tax, our net income is 37.1, and our net is 39,600 for the both of us. And that's the only income we have is my pension and Social Security, no other income.
Well, you, if your gross income is more than 21,800, you do need to file a federal return.
We do.
And
okay.
with you may not owe any taxes, but
you have to file.
You have to file. If your pension, depending on what your pension is from, whether there are some exclusions in Wisconsin for certain pensions, but they're mostly based if you were in the Wisconsin system, and there's some military pension exclusions. And Wisconsin is likes to tax other states' pensions as well. So, yes, you should file a tax return.
All right. Thanks for that, George. And again, welcome to Wisconsin. Gordy in Medford is next. Hi, Gordy.
Hi. I'm planning on setting up a couple of 529 college investments for my two grandchildren. And I'm wondering if I choose the Wisconsin plan, would there be any tax advantages for me, and how would I file to get them?
That's great that you're setting up a plan for your grandkids. If you participate in the EdVest program in Wisconsin, you can deduct from Wisconsin, not from federal, but from your Wisconsin return, up to $3,000 per year per person that you're funding this for.
And is that so? It's a college savings program that adults are doing for children. Does it matter where the child then goes to college, or is it for anywhere?
No, it as far as where you spend those dollars,
yes,
they're available for wherever. But if you enroll, if you live in Wisconsin and you enroll in a program in another state, which some people do because they like the funds better, they like the return better, you can't make that deduction on your state return. So the advantage of going with the Wisconsin program is that you can deduct the $3,000 per year per person.
All right. Well, thanks for that call, Gordy. And we are out of time.
Oh, wow.
Dale, I know. The time just flies. And I hope I know we covered a lot of ground, and hopefully you'll come back and we can do it all again.
I'd be glad to. You love it so much.
I do.
Enthusiastic.
We joke on the breaks that I really enjoy talking about tech stuff. Dale Kunin is a certified public accountant and a certified information technology professional. She's a partner with Wagner CPAs here in Madison. And we really appreciate her sharing her expertise with us. So thanks again, Dale.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And just a reminder, tomorrow it's time for Garden Talk. And Shelley Ryan, the Wisconsin gardener, will be here. She'll give us a sneak peek of the next season of her program on Wisconsin Public Television, and she'll also give us a preview of this weekend's Garden Expo here in Madison, and a lot of Wisconsin Public Radio hosts and other staff will be in our booth. We have a big triple booth at the Garden Expo, so if you're planning on going, I hope you'll stop by and say hello to all of us. There's always a lot to do. Stay tuned for a lot more great information and Chapter a Day coming up next. Jim Fleming is reading from our own Norman Gilliland's novel, and Midnight Catch, and I'm sure you'll enjoy it. And please go and visit our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mealer Show, and Mealer is spelled M-E-I-L-L-E-R. Thanks to Gabby Pedriani for on-air producing today. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.